Welcome everyone to the Federalist Society Minnesota Chapter's first event of the year. This is Justice Breyer, his legacy and thoughts on his replacement. This is a webinar Q&A format, so there is a Q&A option for you to post questions. Our intention is to wait until the end to answer questions, but depending on the question, I may choose to give it up to our presenters earlier. For our presenters, I'm very pleased to introduce first Elizabeth Slattery, who is a senior legal fellow at the Pacific Legal Foundation and is also deputy director of the Center for the Separation of Powers at the Pacific Legal Foundation. She co-hosts the PLF Supreme Court podcast Dist, which is a personal favorite of mine. I highly recommend if you have not checked it out yet. And she also co-authored PLF's report, The Regulatory State's Due Process Deficits. So we are very excited to have Elizabeth here with us. We also have Ramesh Panuru, who recently has become the editor of National Review, which is a leading newspaper publication for anyone who hasn't checked it out, another personal favorite of mine. He also writes for the American Enterprise Institute, Bloomberg, CNN, and others on legal issues, but also in a wide range of everything else. So welcome to Elizabeth and Ramesh. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to kick it off to you guys pretty quickly. So what I'd like to do is just open the floor for you guys to discuss first on a broad level, Justice Breyer, his legacy, what he's brought to the court, what he hoped to accomplish and maybe did or didn't, and maybe some of the key cases that people either love to hate or love to love. So I'll kick it off to you first, Elizabeth, if you wanna kick it off.
Sure. So thank you so much for the invitation to speak today. I'm happy to be here. The first thing I want to note is I found it really refreshing the warm statements from all of Justice Breyer's current colleagues and several of his retired colleagues as well. It really underscores that the Supreme Court is a truly collegial body. There are only 9 of them. They have to work together whether they like each other or not. And so it seems that they really try to set their differences to the side and do the work, even though they don't always agree on the outcome of cases or even the road they need to take to get to that outcome. So I would encourage everyone to go to the Supreme Court's website and you can read the tributes that all of the justices wrote, including all of the retired justices, except for Sandra Day O'Connor, who has kind of retired from public life. But I understand that they were very close friends throughout their time on the bench together and beyond. So in the email traffic that we've had, among the speakers today, one of the questions that Robbie mentioned was, is Breyer fairly considered a part of the liberal wing? What supports this or what doesn't? And I would submit that on the knee-jerk cases, yes, he is absolutely part of the liberal wing. In all the cases where you would expect to see the liberals aligned, he tends to be there. But what I've noticed in digging into his record is that when he does cross over, if you want to call it that, and join the more conservative members of the court, in anything that's remotely hot button or high profile, it tends to be either in unanimous opinions or where another liberal, most often Justice Elena Kagan, has also joined the majority. So we've seen this in several Establishment Clause cases, including Trinity Lutheran, which was a case from about 5 or 6 years ago involving a state grant program for turning recycled tires into playground surfaces. And the state of Missouri would not accept the application of a church-run daycare for a grant to resurface its playground. Justices Breyer and Kagan joined the majority in finding that citing the Establishment Clause to deny their ability to apply for this grant was singling out a religious organization for disfavored treatment. So I thought that was kind of interesting. He's also joined with the conservatives in cases involving religious monuments. So going back to the early 2000s, there was the Ten Commandments case involving the Ten Commandments, a 6-foot-tall Ten Commandments structure outside of the Texas Capitol, and also more recently, a case involving a long-standing cross on public property in Maryland that was about 40 feet tall. He joined the conservatives in both of those cases. And then also in some other cases, Masterpiece Cake Shop, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with, and last term in the Fulton versus Philadelphia case involving the city's exclusion of Catholic social services from being involved in the foster care placement system. In that free exercise case, he also joined the conservatives. So I think his record is a little more nuanced than you might initially expect, but I'd love to hear what Ramesh has to say.
Thank you. Just following up on that, I think one other notable case where you had a kind of Breyer crossover where he voted with the conservatives on the court would be one aspect of the famously complicated NFIB versus Sebelius in 2012, where there was a 7-justice majority to say that the Medicaid provision of Obamacare as originally written was unconstitutionally coercive on the states. So that's another place where it's not quite, you know, it's not one of the Establishment Clause cases. Where you see what by the end of his time on the court had become a kind of a 3-3-2-1 split, you've got sort of Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch sort of holding up the right wall of the court. You've got Kavanaugh, Barrett, and the chief being the more moderate conservatives. And then on the, you've got Breyer and Kagan, sort of, let's say, moderate left, all of these things being relative terms, of course. And then Sotomayor, after the death of Justice Ginsburg, sort of holding down the left flank of the court. That's, you know, obviously there are going to be some cases that don't follow that pattern and that kind of one-dimensional spectrum of the court won't capture sort of all the nuances or any of the reasoning in many of the cases, but it's a good, you know, it's rough and ready and it has a fair amount of predictive power. I'd say though with Justice Breyer, this may be a case of sort of the times making the man rather than vice versa. When you think about his overall legacy, I think you have to say that it's his time on the court is against the backdrop of a rising ascendancy of originalism and textualism that he resisted. And I don't think you have to say anything negative about his abilities or, you know, his intellect or anything, but you'd have to say that he did not resist it especially effectively. I mean by that a couple of things. One is just, you know, obviously just the way elections went, the way confirmation hearings went and so forth, not securing a durable majority for his views, but also, his sort of, he set himself up as a critic of originalism in particular, textualism a little bit less. I don't know that the positive case that he made, the sort of active liberty jurisprudence that he outlined, has really sort of swept all before it on the left in the way that originalism did on the right. And you don't find, you know, look, when Scalia died, even before Scalia died, people wanted another Scalia on the Supreme Court. They wanted somebody who followed his jurisprudence. I don't think that anybody's saying we want another Breyer on the Supreme Court, not in the sense that like people dislike him, just they don't think of him as having a distinctive theory of jurisprudence that needs to be applied more broadly. His fans on the left like the way he voted in a lot of cases, and they like his aspects of his character, but there's not sort of Breyer thought. There isn't even the kind of cult of personality that there grew up around Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Nobody's talking about the notorious SGB right now. So one of the backdrops here is the rising ascendancy, as I said, of originalism and textualism, but another is rising polarization and politicization of the Supreme Court. And I think that is part of this, right? That what partisans are interested in is not any particular sort of school of thought so much as they want somebody who will deliver reliable votes with them on the particularly high profile issues. And that was less the case when Breyer was nominated, although it was already starting to be the case. And it is very much the case now. The last time you had a Democratic appointee who really surprised people or who really crossed the aisle on high profile votes was Byron White, who of course was a Kennedy administration appointee. And I'm not looking to see many surprises from whoever is nominated to replace Breyer.
So that touched on a lot of great points and several that we wanted to cover. Let's focus in on just a few of those. One is towards the end there, the rising polarization of the courts. In the last year, we've seen Breyer come to a lot of speaking and say the court is not polarized and the court is not politicized. Two questions to that. One is, do you think that's fair? And two, do you think Breyer was persuasive in his arguments against polarization or politicization? And I'll kick it off to you first, Elizabeth.
I tend to agree with Justice Breyer's defense of the importance of having an independent judiciary. And I think too often it is people outside of the court who politicize it. It's politicians who stand on the steps of the Supreme Court threatening the winds of change or whatever it was that Chuck Schumer said, or other senators who file amicus briefs, basically threatening to fundamentally alter the structure of the court if the court does not listen, does not bend to its will. To their will. And so, you know, I think that underscores why it's so important to have an independent judiciary and one in which the judges enjoy life tenure and they're protected in theory from, you know, the whims of politics. You know, some people, you know, have pointed out that the pressure campaign seems to have worn Justice Breyer down, you know, going to work every day and seeing the Demand Justice van with Retire Breyer driving around the Capitol. Maybe that wore him down. But I tend to think, you know, he wanted to retire on his own terms. He lived through seeing what happened in recent years with two of his colleagues who were, you know, advanced age and who, you know, in the case of Justice Ginsburg, perhaps held out a little bit longer than, you know, maybe she could have retired a little earlier. But he saw what happens and the turmoil that unfolded, you know, after Justice Scalia passed away and then after Justice Ginsburg passed away. And so I think he wanted to leave on his own terms. And it's not surprising that he decided to announce his retirement in a year when there is a president of, you know, that he, I think, rightly assumes will pick a successor with a similar type of approach to the law. You know, presidents have been, justices have been doing this for a long time. And the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist once said that a justice's decision to retire is not a judicial act. And so there's nothing wrong with deciding when they want to go if it's in, you know, during an administration that they think is going to be favorable.
I think it's a good thing that justices, including Breyer and the Chief Justice, try to see themselves as apolitical, as people who are trying to interpret the law and not just, you know, interpret it to mean whatever they want it to mean, and not just sort of partisan robots. But I think that when you read those sorts of statements from either of those justices or any of the others, you have to take it with a grain of salt. It seems to me that that is more aspirational than it is descriptive of the state of the justices. When, you know, when Chief Justice Roberts would say things like, you know, there are no Democratic judges or no Republican judges, really? I mean, it does seem to actually have a fair amount of predictive power, which party the president who nominated them was in terms of what sorts of decisions they make. We know very well, the Dobbs case coming up, something I've spent a fair amount of time on. I have zero doubts about how Breyer, if he's still there, is going to vote, or Sotomayor is going to vote, or how Breyer's replacement would vote, for that matter. You know, and to the ex- extent that there are any doubts, it's about some of the Republican justices and not about the Democratic ones. But even them, you know, I have I can make some fair guesses about a lot of them, and you know, look forward to the to the affirmative action cases that are coming up. Again, I think we've got a pretty solid idea of where justices will come down on it. You know, not 100% predictive, but reasonably predictive. And you know, I mean, it's just, it's, we're not children here, right? I mean, so I mean, I do think that some of the rhetoric, again, I think there's a valuable role in that, because you know, in a perfect world, the Supreme Court would be more like that. But it's a little absurd to try to maintain with a straight face that that's the way the Supreme Court actually is.
So one other thing I wanted to say about the timing, I think it's interesting that after his very lengthy tenure as the most junior justice, more than a decade, and then waiting out Stevens and Ginsburg, he's finally the senior justice on the left. So that means when Chief Justice Roberts and Clarence Thomas are dissenting, he gets to assign who writes the opinion. And that is a powerful position at the court. And it seems that since Justice Ginsburg's passing, Chief Justice Roberts has been deferential to Breyer and his role as one of the most senior members of the court. You know, he assigned some of the biggest opinions last term to Breyer to write, you know, the Texas versus California, the Affordable Care Act case, Mahanoy, the cursing cheerleader case that was very, you know, hotly anticipated. And so I think it's interesting that he's finally reached this pinnacle on the court, and now he's leaving. But, you know, of course, he has a background in politics. He worked for Senator Ted Kennedy. He knows that, you know, the midterms are coming up, and he certainly would rather be, I think, would have his successor in place before the midterms, when the Democrats still control the Senate and when there's a Democrat in the White House, rather than roll the dice and see what happens, you know, next year or the year after that.
If I could just add there, because Elizabeth just raised a thought for me, which is that Justice Breyer not only has this storied pre-Supreme Court career, but actually has a pre-Supreme Court legacy. And that, you know, arguably, you know, because I've been sort of, let's say, less bowled over by his impact and legacy on the court. You know, as I've been saying, I'd say, you know, like, just to add to that, you know, he says himself, Breyer, that his most important opinion was his dissent in Parents Involved, the case about racial assignment of schools. And, you know, how many people, be honest, on this call have really looked at that or thought about it recently?
I read it every day.
Yeah, but his pre-support Supreme Court legacy includes a significant policymaking role in helping the Ted Kennedy, Jimmy Carter era Democrats embrace deregulation in some key sectors of the economy, and in some ways set the stage for the broader thrust of the Reagan years in economic policy.
So I think that segues us well to another question, if I can, which is, for Justice Breyer, is he going to be one of these judges, when you say their name, people are like, oh, when did he serve? You know, like 50 years from now, is he going to be notable, or is he going to be kind of just a justice who, you know, had a career in the Supreme Court? And I guess with that question, you know, he certainly has a case that he thinks is most important. What would you say in your mind is his most important, you know, opinion, dissent, concurrence? And I'll start with you, Elizabeth.
So, not to put down Justice Breyer, but I think 50 years, 100 years from now, he will not be one of the justices that really stands out in history. You know, I don't think he's going to be remembered like Justice Scalia will be, you know, or some of the notables throughout history, you know, Frankfurter, Brandeis, Marshall, any of the Marshalls. But I think one of my favorite Breyer opinions is in Noel Canning versus NLRB, the recess appointments case. And I thought it was interesting because you know, this resulted from a controversy between President Obama and Mitch McConnell's Senate at that time. President Obama made recess appointments to the NLRB, and I think possibly a few other positions as well, but the NLRB was the case that ended up going to the Supreme Court. And the only problem was the Senate wasn't actually in recess when he made these appointments, but he decided he was deeming them to be in recess because they were not available to confirm his nominees on the schedule that he wanted. And so Breyer, you know, there was a tremendous amount of pressure, I think, from the left for President Obama's appointments to be upheld. And there was a split among the circuit courts because, as I mentioned, there were other positions in government where Obama had done something similar. And so this case goes up to the Supreme Court, and it's unanimous, and it's written by Justice Breyer. Not necessarily who you would picture having writing the majority opinion in a major separation of powers dispute, but nevertheless, he was the author of the majority, and, you know, says, look, the recess appointments clause, it says that you have to follow this procedure. And looking at history and practice, sort of the compromise struck between the office of the presidency and the Senate over the course of history, it has to be a recess that's at least 10 days. We can't have, you know, the Senate's recessing for the night. They're going on a bathroom break. So, you know, we're going to recess appoint all of these people. And I thought that was pretty remarkable. Justice Scalia wrote a concurrence that was joined by several of the other conservatives on the court that would have read the recess appointments clause much narrower to say that only recesses, only vacancies that actually arise during the recess and only in recesses between formal sessions of Congress. So not every time they go on recess, you know, in August or the 4th of July holiday or before Christmas or in April, those wouldn't count. It's just the formal recesses between sessions of Congress. That's how Scalia would have gone and several of the others. But Breyer won the day with his sort of pragmatic, let's be flexible, let's look at what the political branches have agreed to and respect that and not insert ourselves more than we need to. So I think that's probably my favorite of Justice Breyer's opinions.
And Ramesh, before you hop in real quick, would you say, Elizabeth, in general, that Breyer does take a more pragmatic approach in his opinions? Is that kind of the way he tries to do a law in terms of what's workable versus maybe what a certain doctrine or approach would take, I guess, is the word to say that?
Yes, I think flexibility is one of the biggest hallmarks of the Breyer's jurisprudence. I don't think he really subscribes to a particular judicial philosophy. You know, he's not, he's not an originalist. He's not a textualist. He's a big fan of legislative history and trying to get, you know, inside the intent of what was going on behind the scenes when a law was passed. So I think flexibility is the key. And, he never saw a multi-factor balancing test that he didn't love.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that, pragmatism in judicial philosophy, it strikes me as a little bit like realism as a foreign policy doctrine. It's more of a boast than a school of thought. And it tries to make a virtue out of its own capaciousness, but you can fit anything in there, right? So early Breyer, who is more pro death penalty or at least against restricting it, well, that's pragmatic. And then later Breyer, who is more anti death penalty, well, you know, I've thought about this and it just doesn't work. And so now I'm anti-death penalty, and that also is the pragmatic position. And in terms of the sort of how he's going to be remembered question, how we look back on him, it does strike me that, if at some point you got a a solid anti-death penalty Supreme Court majority, you know, in the 2030s or something, then maybe they'll go back and Breyer will look at, Breyer will be seen as one of the people who helped pave the way for that. Otherwise, you know, if that doesn't happen, then maybe his death penalty jurisprudence as it evolved looks a little bit more like Thurgood Marshall's, where, you know, you had the same kind of basic change in, you know, in Marshall's case, it was sort of more self-dramatizingly announced, right? I will no longer tinker with the machinery of death. But it's just, you know, but it's a blip and it doesn't actually change the course of the court. It is a little bit hard to judge these sorts of historical legacy questions right now, not just because obviously the future is unknowable, but also because these things have changed a lot. The politics of the Supreme Court and the politics of celebrity have merged to a degree that they hadn't before. Justice Ginsburg was probably the most famous Supreme Court justice who ever lived, right? It was just the percentage of Americans who knew who she was and could maybe give you a sentence or two about her was higher than almost anybody else. And I think probably her leading competitor in that regard, the number two, although clearly number two by some distance, would have been Justice Scalia. You know, these things are changing pretty rapidly.
That speaking of the death penalty, you know, certainly he's staked out his territory, his markers for why he no longer thinks that the death penalty is consistent with the Constitution. Even though the Constitution explicitly contemplates that the government can put you to death, he nevertheless thinks that it might violate the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. I think similarly, his jurisprudence in the abortion context is an area where it could not mean anything in the next few months, depending on what happens in the Dobbs case. But it is certainly an area where he, you know, he had several notable opinions going back to the early 2000s in striking down Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortions. More recently, he wrote the majority striking down Texas's admitting privileges law, and then the year or two after that, striking down the similar law in Louisiana. And, you know, I think that, so that's an area where he has tried to sort of, I think stake out some territory. You know, I am not terribly impressed with his jurisprudence in that area. You know, in the Texas case, for example, he ignores all the evidence that led the legislators to pass the law in the first place. You know, he ignored the record showing just how horrible some of these clinics were, you know, lack of sterilization, holes in the floor, rats coming up, you know, patient dumping, where, you know, doctors would basically tell their patients to go to the hospital if they experienced complications and then not actually follow through and join them there. So, you know, he ignored all of that because he felt that it was an undue burden on women trying to access abortion coverage. But that is certainly an area where he has written several of the notable opinions, you know, in the last 20 years.
If I could jump in one more thing, and I'd be really interested, Elizabeth, if you agree with this. It does seem to me, even as somebody who is basically critical of the idea of judicial pragmatism, that the area to which it may be best suited, it has to do with some of these complicated technological / statutory issues. And I'm thinking particularly of Oracle v. Google, where whatever you think of the outcome, he sort of knew what he was talking about in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have had confidence that some of the other justices would have been up to speed on all of those issues. And it just seems to me that, you know, like if this is going to make sense anywhere, and this is the sort of place that it is going to make sense. And I wonder if after he's gone, we're going to feel a little bit of a lack of that kind of expertise, which again, you know, I don't think, you know, you see in all the justices.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it underscores the importance of having diversity of experience among, you know, members of the court. I think it's a shame that other than one justice, all of them went to either Harvard or Yale for law school. Most of them, you know, sort of forged a very similar path to the Supreme Court, you know, top of their class, clerkship, you know, either at the appellate or Supreme Court level, possibly a stint in the federal government, maybe an appeals court judgeship for a while, and then on to the Supreme Court. So I think it's great that that one of the, I know we'll get to the possible nominees in a little bit, but I think it's great that one of the alleged front runners has a different path. She's very much an outside the beltway pick, and did not go to Harvard or Yale. So I think, you know, it's important to have a diversity of experience, because I think you're right, Ramesh, that there are some areas where Breyer's administrative law background has certainly been a benefit to the court.
And I think that that's a great time to segue maybe into his potential replacements. I wanted to give you guys, if you had any other thoughts on his legacy or something you wanted to add. We may have some time at the end too, of course, but if not, then I think we can start talking about who might be the newest justice, who might be replacing Justice Breyer.
There is one more aspect of his jurisprudence that I want to hit on briefly. So I have to admit, I had not really done a deep dive into Justice Breyer's jurisprudence before. You know, he was a little bit of an afterthought, I have to admit, among some of the justices. But as I started to read about, you know, I knew his Establishment Clause cases, I knew those, and, you know, some of his administrative law opinions and separation of powers cases. But I'm surprised by, from a liberal perspective, how bad his criminal justice record is. He's up there with, from the left's perspective, he's up there with Justice Alito. And I was really surprised. You know, a lot of people were critics of Justice Scalia, but people would note that, you know, on Fourth Amendment and Sixth Amendment, you know, criminal law, constitutional issues, he was very much pro-criminal defendant. And that was not because he was personally pro-defendant or, you know, pro-government, but because the Constitution is in some ways pro-criminal defendant. And so he was trying to bring the Fourth and Sixth Amendments back in, you know, closer to an original understanding of what the text actually means. Breyer's kind of the opposite. When you look at some of his, you know, the cases where he either joined a majority or joined a dissent, you know, in a number of Fourth Amendment and Sixth Amendment cases, I was very surprised. And so I have to imagine that whoever replaces him will probably be from that perspective, more criminal defendant friendly than Justice Breyer has been.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think it reflects the evolution of American liberalism. A liberal Democratic justice appointed in the 60s or 70s, or even a liberal Republican justice appointed in the 70s, since there were no liberal Democrats appointed in the 70s, would have been more pro-criminal defendant, were more pro-criminal defendant. And I think a liberal justice today would, but I think in the 80s and 90s, you had that particular politics of the tail end of the crime wave and a certain kind of democratic defensiveness about crime and a certain kind of alarm, both about how high crime was and about how much it was hurting liberalism. And that, you know, you see that in the Clinton administration, and you see that in the Clinton administration judicial appointees as well. But it was a very sort of specific historical moment.
Mm-hmm. And I read recently, I did not realize this, that during his time, he was basically on loan from Harvard to Senator Ted Kennedy's office as his chief counsel. And he helped write the bill that created the U.S. Sentencing Commission. I knew that he had served on the Sentencing Commission when it was first created, but he actually helped shape the commission that he ultimately served on. So I thought that was kind of an interesting footnote to his pre-judicial career.
And I think that's a great segue to our first of his potential replacements. Now, President Biden during the campaign, and once again, once Justice Breyer announced his retirement, said that he would be picking a Black woman to serve in the Supreme Court. The chatter, I guess, around DC and around the newspapers is that there are three likely options. One is current judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was a former public defender and who also was a district judge on the District of D.C. The other one would be Leandra Kruger, who is a justice on the California Supreme Court, and then as well as Judge Michelle Childs, who is a judge in the District of South Carolina on the federal level. So what I'd be interested to know is what are notable maybe decisions that these women have put out as judge or justices, or what is something notable from their career that we should look to as a potential tea leaf for what they may be like with the justice? And I think we can start with whoever you guys would wish, but I think just on the criminal justice realm, it might make most sense to start with Judge Jackson. I'll kick that off to either one of you.
So the first thing that has struck me about Judge Jackson is, and Ramesh, your NRO colleague, Ed Whalen, has written about this extensively on bench memos, is that as a trial court judge, it's understandable that trial court judges are sometimes going to get reversed on appeal. I don't know the statistics for her reversal rate versus other district court judges, but from what I've read, she has a pretty bad reversal rate. And in fact, the DC Circuit, where she serves now, recently in the last month, I believe, reversed one of her trial court opinions from before she joined the appeals court. So the hits keep coming from trial court Judge Jackson. So I think that's kind of interesting. And, you know, in the cases where her district court opinions have been reversed, it tends to be an ideologically diverse panel. You'll have Democratic appointees, Republican appointees, a mix of them, all agreeing that she got it wrong. And so, you know, I wonder what exactly is going on there, but I think that's kind of a notable thing to point out is, you know, that she does not seem to have a stellar record in terms of reversal rate.
So maybe a little bit more information about me than you care about, but when the Supreme Court justices, when there's a vacancy, I tend to sort of obsessively pore over the records and differences if it's a Republican in the White House, because I just tend to be a lot better sourced there and have a much better sense of who is in the pipeline and who's a serious candidate and who isn't. Whereas, you know, I don't have that kind of access when there's a Democratic administration. And as I said, you know, I do think that polarization has made these things really matters of kind of small nuances. So I haven't really made a study of these potential nominees. Although, I mean, I should say, you know, sort of in criticism of myself, I probably should have, because they've narrowed it down so far just by having the demographic criteria that they have, that it wouldn't be that hard to do that exercise. The differences that strike me among them are sort of small, but they're also political. So in the case of Childs, if I'm the White House and I see that you've got a pretty much guaranteed vote for her from Lindsey Graham in a 50-50 Senate, that's got to be a pretty strong argument for going with her. Now, on the other hand, there has been some murmuring on the left that she's not as reliable. Who knows if that's really well-grounded? These things can often turn out to be wrong when people actually go on the Supreme Court. I mean, go back and look at the things people said about David Souter during his confirmation hearings, for example. You know, Molly Yard for now was testifying, you know, women would be dying in back alleys by the thousands if he were confirmed. If I were the White House, I would be thinking, you know, maybe a little bit of petulance from the left is worth it to get that A, guaranteed or semi-guaranteed confirmation, and B, to be able to say, you know, bipartisan support for this nominee. But, you know, this White House has been more sensitive to the agitations of the left than I would have thought was healthy for it before, and they could be again. None of these nominees seems like, well, that's sort of a crazy choice. It's an obviously wrong choice in terms of getting through the Senate and just sort of being implausible as a Supreme Court justice.
So one thing I want to dovetail on that, Senator Graham has come out and been supportive of Judge Michelle Childs. I would point out, though, that he has never voted against a Democratic president's nominee for the Supreme Court. But Senator Tim Scott has also been supportive. So that could be, you know, an additional Republican supporter that, you know, could sweeten the deal for the Biden White House.
It's hard to picture them voting for that nominee and Murkowski and Collins not voting for that nominee also.
That's right.
Maybe narrow in on something with Judge Childs to talk about is, she is currently a district court judge. And my understanding of most of the nominees or most of the current justices is they don't have that district court experience. And most of them are appellate level or appellate level. So can you give some insight into maybe what that would look like for litigators or even just for jurisprudence to have a judge who maybe is more close to the ground than most of the other justices have been for a long time or ever?
Yeah, so Judge Childs served 4 years in a South Carolina state court, and I think she's been on the federal district court for about 12 years now. You know, so she's presided over many criminal and civil trials. She's issued a couple of noteworthy district court opinions that have gotten some media attention, including one during the lead up to the 2020 primaries and then general election involving the state's witness requirement for absentee ballots. She enjoined the state from enforcing that. It was ultimately, overturned by the Supreme Court on an emergency basis. But I think that would be useful to have another district court judge with that body of experience at the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor is the only other current justice with district court experience. And, you know, like I said earlier, I think it's helpful to have justices with a variety of experiences. We don't need all of them to come from the DC Circuit. Where several of our current and recent former justices have served, serving in the Solicitor General's office or the Office of Legal Counsel. Now, of course, these are all things that apply to one or more of the leading candidates. But I think it's interesting that when you look at the three of them, they all sort of offer something different and seem to speak to a different demographic of Biden's base. Now, you know, I think Ramesh kind of alluded to the fact that there are some people who are questioning Judge Child's record as it relates to labor issues. She was the high up in the state's Department of Labor, and she also was a commissioner on the state's Workers' Compensation Commission, and worked in private practice in South Carolina for a number of years. But I also think that Judge Jackson's experience as a public defender would be unique among the current Supreme Court, and she has talked about how that experience, you know, it was kind of a mid-career detour that she decided to take, which I think is really admirable, how she saw just how little people know about the legal system. And she carried that forward when she became a district court judge and tried to always ensure that defendants, you know, criminal defendants knew, understood the process. And so, you know, that is a unique perspective that we don't currently have on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Well, so then maybe let's talk about Justice Kruger, because I feel like she gets kind of the least amount of attention. from my understanding, the last time a justice was elevated from a state level court to Supreme Court was Justice O'Connor from the Arizona Court of Appeals. Am I correct with that, or is there someone else? And what does it look like to maybe come from a state Supreme Court level to federal court? Do we think that there are anything to be gleaned from that?
Yeah, I think Justice Souter served on the New Hampshire Supreme Court, but then he was briefly on probably the First Circuit, the first federal appeals court. So you're right, we haven't had many state Supreme Court justices come up to the U.S. Supreme Court in modern history. She has a sterling resume, Harvard undergrad, Yale Law School. She clerked for John Paul Stevens at the Supreme Court. She worked at several white shoe law firms in Washington. She was an attorney in the Solicitor General's office for 6 years. She worked for, in that office, she worked at the tail end of the Bush administration in a career position, and then through a decent part of the Obama administration, where she worked for legal luminaries across the spectrum, Paul Clement, Elena Kagan, Neil Katyal, Don Verrilli, and all of them have said really glowing things about her. She argued about 12 cases before the Supreme Court. Notably, one was one of the Obama administration's biggest losses in Hosanna Tabor versus the EEOC, where the court unanimously ruled against the government in its case, arguing that the ministerial exception to employment law does not apply to a teacher who was fired by a Lutheran school. The court unanimously agreed with the school that they could fire that teacher because she did qualify as a minister. Justice Kruger also served in the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, which is considered by many to be the smartest of the smartest at DOJ. Justices Scalia and Chief Justice Rehnquist both headed up that office and said it was, you know, the best job of their, one of them said it was the best job of their life and great practice experience to have before becoming a judge. She's been compared, perhaps because she worked with her, but she's been compared to Justice Kagan as a little bit harder to pigeonhole. Her jurisprudence on the California Supreme Court is not unlike Justice Breyer's. Sometimes she's with the liberals, sometimes she's with the, I guess you would call them conservatives. I don't know how conservative they actually are.
It is California, yeah.
California Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But, you know, I looked at some of her cases and she doesn't seem to have, she's not voting in lockstep with one side or the other, which ultimately I think is the kind of jurisprudence we would hope to see from any judge, that they aren't just voting for, you know, one party or one cause over all others. So I think that, to be candid, I think one of the reasons that her star is kind of falling, at least from what it seems. I mean, maybe, you know, President Biden, he isn't asking me for advice. So I don't know if he is seriously considering her, but apparently she turned down the offer to be Solicitor General. So maybe her ties with the White House are not as strong. And she also has by all accounts had a very privileged upbringing. And so that might not be, sort of the picture that they want, you know, for the photo ops and, you know, to paint the picture of this nominee. They might want someone with a little bit of a different upbringing. So that's sort of my assessment of Justice Kruger.
Yeah, Ed Whalen, who Elizabeth has already mentioned, who's one of, who writes a lot about legal issues for National Review, he speculated that that those are some of the reasons why she probably wouldn't get picked. I wonder whether those in particular will be such strong reasons. But I think that there's another one, and it has to do specifically with this question of what difference does it make coming from a state court. I think it does create a kind of distortion in how the judge is evaluated based on which state court. Because the California Supreme Court's very liberal, and somebody who would be a very liberal justice on some other state Supreme Court might not look as liberal in California. And that could affect the way that progressives view the nomination. That might be a reason for them to prefer one of the other candidates who, at the very least, they don't know would be as moderate as Kruger is, again, moderate in the California context.
And so, go ahead, Elizabeth.
I was just going to say one of the questions that Robbie suggested we might get to in our email traffic before this event was about President Biden, candidate Biden, and then President Biden pledging to pick a Black woman for his first pick on the Supreme Court. And I'm curious, Ramesh, what you think about how people compare that to, say, Reagan saying, you know, he was gonna make every effort to nominate a woman to the mm-hmm. Supreme Court, or you know, Trump saying that he was saving Justice Barrett for a later seat for to replace Ginsburg. I see some nuances between those scenarios, but I'm curious what you think about that.
So I think that there are, there are a couple of issues that tend to get jumbled together when we think about this. There's the question of whether it's in principle wrong to have that kind of pledge. There's the question of whether, even if it is in principle all right to do that, whether one in particular makes sense. And then there's the question of the execution of it. I think that, I don't think there's anything in principle wrong with suggesting that, it would be good to have a Black woman on the Supreme Court, or in the case of O'Connor, it would be good to have a woman on the Supreme Court. It's kind of crazy to think about the fact that we've never had a Black woman on the Supreme Court at this point in our history. But you do narrow the field a lot, and that's just a contingent matter of what happens to be the case. I think that saying, as Reagan did in the 80 campaign, pretty gratuitously, given how strong a victory he had then, that he was going to appoint a woman, really limited his options and made it much harder to fulfill his desire to have a conservative Supreme Court justice. So I think that was a mistake, actually. Putting Thomas up in place of Marshall, where interestingly the public line was that his race didn't play a role in it. That's what the Bush administration maintained. I think it made it much easier to get him confirmed. The one reason Thomas was confirmed after a controversial process when Bork wasn't was that a lot of Southern Democrats with a lot of Black constituents felt that they needed to vote for him. And I think that sort of political judgment seems to me kind of thing that just, you know, that's just inevitable. It would be kind of nutty to think that you can't do it. And then finally, there's the question of execution. And it seems to me it's one thing to say, you know, in your office, I think it would be better to have, I want to appoint the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. And it's a different thing to do that as a public pledge in a way that I think undercuts that nominee and the power of that nomination moment when the person is finally announced. But then again, to return back to the politics, you know, look, he was left for dead, Biden, as a candidate. He needed Jim Clyburn's support to come back. South Carolina and Black voters in South Carolina saved him. And Clyburn said he wanted this. So, you know, at a certain point, you have to ask, well, you know, would he even be in the position to be making any nominations if he hadn't made this pledge?
I think you're right that it ultimately backfired on President Reagan because there just were not that many women to choose from. And so he ended up with, Justice O'Connor, who kind of saw her role a little differently than I think justices on the Supreme Court should view their role. I think on the Trump saying he was saving Justice Barrett for RBG's seat, you know, I don't think there's any indication that he picked her because she was going to provide some sort of unique women's perspective. She had been vetted already. She was in the front, you know, one of the front runners to replace Kennedy. And, you know, it didn't surprise me at all that that she was the logical choice for his third appointment to the Supreme Court. You know, I think you're right that it's different saying it publicly and making this a promise, and whether that will have an impact on that eventual nominee or and eventual justice once they arrive to the Supreme Court. Because of course, the three women that we've been talking about, they're all highly qualified. They're at the top of their game. But I think this pledge has sort of tainted the process a bit. And if Biden were listening to me, I think he should have put out a list like Trump did when he was a candidate with, here are the people I will consider. I thought that was a really great move. It showed the American people exactly who he was going, the type of people he was going to consider. And, you know, groups like Demand Justice had already given Biden a leg up and started to create lists like these. So he could have picked and put together a list like that. So I think all presidential candidates should put out a list of who they would consider for Supreme Court vacancies. Yeah. That would be a great transparency measure in the presidential campaign process.
Yeah, but there's more demand for it.
We are almost at time. We only got about 1 minute left. I thought there was a lot of great insight here, and I really appreciate it. It does seem to me like the takeaway is, you know, there might be some change in criminal law jurisprudence, at least on an opinion basis, but otherwise, not going to see a lot of change from Justice Breyer to any of the three potential that we've discussed today. Does that seem fair?
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Okay. Any other questions we got have pretty much been answered. Is there any parting thoughts you'd like to give? Any other insights we haven't gotten to cover yet?
No, now we just wait. Wait for the nominee.
Yeah, and thank you for a great discussion.
Yeah, so thank you all so much for joining us. For those who are listening in, this will be recorded. This has been recorded and will be posted. And if you are at all interested in joining the Federalist Society, you can do so on the main website and then join the Minnesota chapter. We would love to have you. Thank you again, Elizabeth Slattery and Ramesh Panuru, for joining us. It's great. Really appreciate your insight, and we hope to have you here again sometime.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.